composed, but it's the only way that the audio is good enough. One of the first things that's interesting about Nathaniel Hawthorne is his name. And it is a big representation of what Nathaniel Hawthorne signifies. If anything, Nathaniel Hawthorne represents guilt and represents sin. And there are two keywords that are representative for what he brings to the table of romanticism. It's these two elements of constant guilt expressed in his work and expressed in his in the characters that he creates, and a distinct analysis or interest in this idea of sin. As you can see, the second semester that we're going to deal with has a very heavy component of romanticism. In the first semester, when we started the classes, I said that most of the course was about romanticism, and this true to a certain extent, because in the this miscellaneous box of romanticism, we've come to feel comfortable fitting in things that aren't purely romantic, everything that goes beyond practically Mary Rowlandson. We just put it into that box of romanticism. And romanticism is actually a thing that grows on the American cultural scene little by little, and is going to grow towards the 19th century. Right now we're at the core of the 19th century. And these three authors that I mentioned before I started to record, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Herman Melville, and Edgar Allan Poe, can be understood as this trinity of darkness, this trinity of the dark feeling of romanticism. If we go back to the first semester and we remember Emerson represents the opposite. And this is why romanticism is such an interesting movement, because mostly the growth comes through opposition. We're going to see a lot of opposition in these writers, and therefore it's going to help you when Professor Gibert sets one of these questions of comparing and contrasting. The contrasting part is already said. It's just a matter of looking for the comparison. All of these authors are going to have a love-hate relationship with transcendentalism, and in the case of Edgar Allan Poe, it's directly hate-hate. It's the direct opposite and very confrontational with what transcendentalism means. In Nathaniel Hawthorne and Herman Melville, we're still going to find many elements that remind us, that resonate with things that we find that sound similar to transcendentalism. This interest in nature, which is very romantic, this using nature as a central force. And again, we're going to have a look after we see this first super interesting block of romantic writers, which I consider probably the pinnacle of American romanticism. From this point on, romanticism is going to wane little by little. It's going to be transformational. It's going to transform into something very different and also very special and very important for American literature as it gears towards a realism that has a very naturalistic view of it, but from a different perspective than romanticism. We'll get there. We'll see that. This first class, I'm going to do a quick rundown of all the authors that we're going to see in the second semester. Those are the dates that are in the presentation. They're going to be in all the presentations, so you don't need to memorize it, but in case you want to write down more or less how to structure preparing for them. From these first four authors, we're going to see our first poet of the second semester. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, very strange case within the authors that we're seeing, because this author just doesn't seem romantic. In fact, when you read the work, you say, why is this author even in the book? Is he good enough? Does he deserve to be in this collection of incredible writers? Do you recognize this? I mean, these are names that resonate very much. If I say Nathaniel Hawthorne, maybe some of you say, I don't really know who this guy is. Why is the teacher so excited about him? But if I say the Scarlet Letter, some of you probably say, the guy from the Scarlet Letter. Okay, I get it. So you have the Scarlet Letter, Moby Dick, and everything that Edgar Allan Poe does, how he takes the short story to new heights. So everything about these three authors is incredible. Henry Wadsworth-Longfellow is like an uncomfortable guest in the middle of these first 4 minutes, but it makes sense because for the time, these guys were tremendously unsuccessful. They had they didn't have a tremendous reputation. They didn't become overnight millionaires because of their work. In fact, they lived a miserable life. Most of them did not succeed in living as writers. And Edgar Allan Poe had died in a miserable way, and his editors gave him a terrible reputation that lasted for almost a century. And Edgar Allan Poe was almost forgotten and had to be rescued by modern-day scholars that appreciated and took his work in a new perspective. We're going to see how these forgotten author items is a very important topic in this second semester. We have another case which is as important as Edgar Allan Poe in the first semester. This lady you probably have not heard about, or you've only heard about in a mild way. Kate Chopin is considered probably the mother of feminism, and from the feminist point of view, her dimension is incredible. She's a very important writer. Because many of you study Comentario de Textos Literarios of one list, and before you take this subject, probably you've become familiar with this author, but her dimension is actually very big. Up to the 1960s, she had been absolutely forgotten. And that goes to show that sometimes literary quality and literary recognition travel not in parallel, but in absolutely divergent directions. And that these authors are the core of our syllabus for the second semester represents that they are a very good representation of the different styles and different types of authors that we have for the second semester, but not necessarily because they achieve the recognition, something that we already started to become familiar with in the second semester. One of the most important works of current literature is a revised a biography of Frederick Douglass that I had the opportunity of purchasing very recently. I haven't had the opportunity of reading it yet. This is going to take us to a very important moment, which the three authors that we mentioned before that have a romantic and gothic background, it decided to ignore almost completely the American Civil War. We come from the War of Independence barely one century before, and we tumble towards the American Civil War. What is the representation of this incredible turmoil and upturn in American reality? The representation of both a slave and both abolitionists that wrote a very significant a novel called Uncle Tom's Cabin is going to focus us on the period that are these drums of war. Without time to recover from first this Gothic whirlpool and then this pre and post Civil War momentum, we're going to fall into the lap of the pinnacle or one of the initial peaks of American poetry. American poetry has been relevant in many moments of history. It became incredibly relevant thanks to the works of Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson. Absolutely divergent poets, but which can also be compared in very significant ways. And this is just one of the important points of American poetry, along with American modernism or the Beat Generation. It's at the same height in terms of importance. Next year or the following years, you will study contemporary American literature, and you'll understand how this, what you studied a couple of years before about Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, is at the same height as what you study afterwards with T.S. Eliot or with the Beat Generation. From then on, I talked about this moment of these first authors being the summit, but also the beginning of the end of Romanticism, which fades in a very sudden way. It plummets into nothingness because there's already a very strong force that if, for example, in British literature, had it come at the turn of the century and realism takes the stage, and we're going to start to see how Mark Twain, Henry James, Kay Chapin, and Stephen Crane close the syllabus of the second semester with a bang. Each of these authors are going to be very significant, they're going to be very different, very rich. I think they're going to provide you with a depth of literature that is fundamental for you to understand American literature as a whole. After that overview of the semester, let's start with Nathaniel Hawthorne. I'm going to try to go as fast as possible because today's story is especially long, and sometimes I run out of time trying to cover it in the class. I always bring a quote of each author to exemplify the work. It's normally taken from the work that we have in hand, but not in this case. This is something that we can use as a way of talking about romanticism as a whole. Romanticism is not always easy to read, despite Nathaniel Hawthorne Jr.'s paradoxical claim. But for sure, writing in a transcendental product, to use that word, writing in a significant and long-lasting way is not something that comes through inspiration and automatic writing. These works are written and rewritten, reviewed, redone. And we're going to see today in the case of Nathaniel Hawthorne how his work is very precise and built as a very laborious task. In the next author in Herman Melville, we're going to see how after almost finishing a book, he decided to rewrite most of it because he didn't like his tale, and afterwards turned into Moby Dick. Thank God he did decide to rewrite that story, because probably the original story had a completely different focus and qualities. In the first part, we're going to talk about the objectives of the human. I normally summarize the same objectives that you can find here in the study guide. I want to remind you that the study guide, just working with one hand, is kind of complicated. You know, I did that last year, and everybody told me, I can't hear you. Yeah, you sound very messed up. I did this one class, and they said, oh, you sound perfect. And I said, oh, yeah. So now, apparently I sound perfect when I do this, which is very unfortunate. Every unit has a different focus after talking about the objective. And in this unit, the focus is about plots. Okay, so this is like a step-by-step guide of how to become a scholar and the different elements of knowledge that you have to bring to the table. And the study guide is really an interesting book. If you don't have, if you don't want to buy it, or hello, American Literature.
No, excuse me. I was sent by a couple of doors, and they asked me to fetch two registers. One was the theory of a particular subject, sorry.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, I feel just like you. I'll go back again.
Okay.
What's your name, by the way?
Nick. I don't think Nick has passed today. I think he has passed tomorrow.
No, I was
okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Fine. Okay, so in this unit in particular, there are four key objectives that we want to achieve. The first one is learning about why Nathaniel Hawthorne is one of the major writers of American Renaissance. This other way of calling romanticism that we have bestowed upon ourselves. This Renaissance is a weird name because there is nothing to be reborn from. There was no literature before. So it would be like a sort of a Renaissance if we're going to be precise. But Americans were never too good at French. And the elements that make Nathaniel Hawthorne distinct, his prose style. And this prose style that is reworked iteratively until it's very well thought, and there is a lot of depth in each word that you read, is something that we're going to find not only in Romanticism, it's going to become a trait of realism, and it's going to move towards contemporary writers, modernists, or even postmodernist writers. As examples, probably Mark Twain that comes to mind as a very polished writer. Ernest Hemingway is a typical writer that you read, and everything seems very easy English, but it's been very, very well thought, every word is written. In the case of Nathaniel Hawthorne, the same amount of labor was put into what he wrote and what he wanted to say with each word. There's a very conscious creation, and it's not by any means an automatic work or a first draft type of publication. He published he is unanimously, I would say, in a contemporary fashion, acclaimed for his aesthetic qualities, and he has one of the central positions in the American literary canon. Even though, because of a matter of length, we don't read the Scarlet Letter in this course. We read Young Goodman Brown, which is a story that if I had to guess an author, I would first guess that it's Herman Melville's instead of Nathaniel Hawthorne, and that is another trait. These authors sound very similar. If we only have the opportunity of being exposed to one story of each, but if you go beyond, and just because you want to extend reading, you read more on Edgar Allan Poe, you read more stories by Nathaniel Hawthorne, you read more stories by Herman Melville, you'll see how there was an obvious influence that you never know if it's a direct influence of one over the other, or if it was an influence of the time. In some cases, it's very obvious because Herman Melville was hugely, had a huge appeal for Hawthorne's work. In the case of Melville, when we study him next week, we're going to see that it is a typical mentorship type of relationship, the one that Herman Melville had with Nathaniel Hawthorne. Nathaniel Hawthorne influenced Melville. There is an age here from Tulsa. Melville was younger than Hawthorne, and he always looked up to him as a literary father figure. He had several literary father figures, but with Emerson very soon, all of these people, either directly or indirectly, in the case of Melville and Hawthorne, directly, interacted with Emerson. But I think that interaction was a good way of finding their own voice, of separating from this transcendental spirit that Emerson provided. We're going to use a word for the first time, psychological romance. What does that mean? It means building a character with a psychological depth. And we're going, to see how this psychology of the character is one of the biggest common traits that Edgar Allan Poe, Herman Melville, and Nathaniel Hawthorne bring to the table. It's one of the significant items that the three of them expand literature beyond the frontiers where they were. For example, in Washington Irving or in James Fenimore Cooper, we have very flat characters where we don't normally get to know how they think, how they feel, what their aspirations are. In the case of these, let's say, second wave romantic authors, that is the core of their interest. They're interested in creating a rounder character that is much more complex and that has a psychological dimension that we haven't seen before. That's what sets them apart from what we have read to the moment in American literature and brings American literature a step forward into a new, unexplored, uncharted territory. But at the same time, the same way, and I say it's very easy to contrast transcendentalism and these more darker Gothic romantic authors. There is a tendency of inserting, sometimes with a good reason, sometimes in a fashion that seems certainly random, mysterious and supernatural elements. It's going to be a very marked tendency to include the supernatural. And from the three stories that we read, Moby Dick doesn't have many supernatural parts in the passages that we read, but Young Goodman Brown is sprinkled with supernatural from beginning to end. And the Ground Poe's the Mask of Red Death, I think it's the Mask of Red Death, yeah. There is supernatural from the beginning to the end. Another key word that we have to use. Allegory. And subversive. We're going to be able to use allegory and subversive very much with Nathaniel Hawthorne, and also we're going to be able to find connections or segues in Herman Melville and Edgar Allan Poe. What this means is that it uses a Calvinist structure, the allegory with a religious purpose, and it turns it against itself. The work that we're going to read today has the structure of an allegory, but it's turning the story against itself. The principles of it's supposed to create an edifying lesson for self-improvement. All of these ideas that we've heard and that I have been drumming into your heads week after week in the first semester, an active purpose, and Puritan play style, blah, blah, blah. Forget about it. It's going to do exactly the opposite. Non-didactic purpose, or anti-didactic purpose. Maybe to don't learn the lesson from the story. And Puritan play style, you bet. You get the opposite. You get a very intricate and sometimes difficult to follow style. But once you work through it, it becomes quite enjoyable. And of course, often has this ambivalence, and this is where the subversiveness comes in towards Puritanism. Connecting to his biography, he's going to have a very significant incident happen in his early life, becoming an orphan at an early age, and his father dies of yellow fever at age four, and he decides, one of the elements of separating himself from his family lineage, to include a W in his name that wasn't there, and going from Hawthorne to Hawthorne. Why is he putting that W? Apparently, and most probably, because he felt shame for his family lineage. The immediate and the past. The immediate because the death of his father turns his family into an impoverished one, and his mother is forced to make a terrible living, and has significant problems providing for her children. Nathaniel Hawthorne's father family wants to have nothing to do with these impoverished relatives, and that creates a sense of resentment in Hawthorne that is very obvious. But if we look further, and we focus on the place where he was born, Salem. I think Salem is one of these places that nobody can place on a map, but everybody knows what it stands for. Say Salem, you think witches. I say Salem, you say witches. This was a concert. So what was Salem? Sorry, Salem. Yes. He was born in Salem. His family, they belonged to the Hawthornes, were part of the founding Puritans of Salem, and the Scarlet Letter is placed in Salem, it's set in Salem, and it's a testimony to the idea that Hawthorne had of his community and also his relatives. His father, sorry, an ancestor, not his father, of course, an ancestor, a Hawthorne, was one of the judges in the witch trial that burned witches just because they were sinful. And again, we get this idea of sin coming into the sea. Sound is not very good. I don't know. What can I do? It's always the same thing. Let me see. Araceli, I can't do anything. I mean, this is as close as I can get to a microphone. And who is Molina? Let me see. That should be Jose Rafael. Well, I think, yes, of course, the class will be in the ABI conferences. I normally just publish them and leave them in the open in case people from other parts of Spain don't have a tutor or can't go to class, and they can they just watch my classes here. So they should be available over the week. If I forget to post them, it's because I forgot. So just send me an email, and I'll remember to post them. Okay. So going back to what I was saying, if you have any questions, just type them there, and I'll try to answer as soon as possible. He was from Salem, and the idea that he connects to Salem is this idea of sin and what I said before, and remorse, guilt. Okay, so he feels guilty for his lineage, guilty for his family past, and I think that this is something that is visible in every single piece of work that you can read from Hawthorne in one way or another. These elements seem to be recurrent and repetitive in his work. In some, in a very, very obvious way, because they're central to the story, the one we're going to read today, Younger Than Brown, or in the Scarlet Letter, for sure, in other very famous short stories that he wrote, like the original Sin, the same. It's always this idea of sin, guilt, and remorse. And probably to modern readers, when we read this, when you think about this religion, so what? Maybe when you have this idea that religion is not so core to your life, or you have to understand the settings and how important religion was. Religion was the base of the community, especially in Puritan strongholds like Salem. Salem suffered a decline after the early 19th century, after around 1812, because of embargo situations. Salem lost its position of power, but it was a very relevant center of Puritan life. And we know that everything in Puritan life revolves around religion. If we think of a typical religious Puritan community, we could probably get closer to the idea if we think about those movies where we see Quakers appear in the movies, that everything is about their traditions and how they go around their lives in terms of how they serve God. And therefore, for an author that belongs to that community to denounce publicly the cynicism of the Puritan community, and using the same instruments that the Puritans used to instruct the community against them and to mock them, is probably the biggest form of humiliation that a community can receive. So, of course, many people did not like Hawthorne for his work, and that was a reason, because he was rebelling against the community he belonged to. All of these colleges that nowadays are just other colleges in the United States, like Bowdoin, were extremely religious. He attended Bowdoin for 4 years. He pursued the idea of becoming a lawyer or a doctor. And in that group, that elite group, again, we said studying was something that only the upper classes did, but not the wealthy upper classes. It was more of the spiritual upper classes. There were certain people that belonged to certain communities that could study in certain places. There were other people from other places that couldn't study. For example, Edgar Allan Poe would not have access to a college like this. What type of friends did he make? He made friends like future president Franklin Pierce, or this other author that we're going to see in 3 weeks, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the most important poet of his time. someone that you've never heard about, that you probably will never hear about after you finish this course, because he has lost all of his importance. But that's part of the process. That's why it's important to learn about him, because he's not important nowadays. So Hawthorne became an author through necessity. And we've seen other cases of authoring through necessity. And this is a case where he wished to be published, he wished to become an author, and he struggled. His first work, The Fanshawe, for him was a failure, and it became an embarrassment for him. It became such an embarrassment that his purpose in life turned into trying to burn all the copies that he could find of the book. He was not completely successful because Fanshawe has survived him and is can still be read. Hawthorne was not very close metaphorically to Emerson, even though physically he was very close because he was renting one of his properties. That's the way Hawthorne came into contact with Emerson, living in the vicinity of Concord. I said the previous semester that Concord was going to have a lot of importance in the course, and this is the reason. He had a relationship of or mild affection, but cultural collision. There weren't many elements in common that connected Hawthorne to the spirit of the Thoreaus and the Alcotts of the Emersons. But there is one that is very significant. All of these authors, I think we have to compare them, insert nature into their writings. But for example, Emerson, Thoreau, and the Transcendentalists were more experiential writers that wrote about the reality of the world, travel books of experience, books of thoughts and reflections of the world, of the nature. Hawthorne turned to fiction, and his view of nature is not the liberated nature that we see in Emerson. It's the dark, mysterious, and sometimes threatening nature that we see in Hawthorne. So it's a completely different view. Emerson was one of his relations, and as well Thoreau, Melville, and Longfellow, a lifetime friend. He served as an American consul in Great Britain and died while Pierce was campaigning for re-election in 1864. Regarding his works, he can be considered one of the big writers, one of the major writers of the century, one of the major writers of American literature. In this pinnacle of literature, we can place other writers such as Henry James, Melville, Poe, and he also shared the same space and the same time, and also the same social environment with other authors that were extremely famous at the time, like Longfellow. All of these authors that I mentioned before had a very good opinion of Hawthorne's work and reviewing his work. And this is something really interesting. I think I mentioned it when I talked about Benjamin Franklin, and this is when it really turns real. One of the most popular works nowadays for people that are finished undergraduate studies like yours is to pursue a career as a critic, to enter the world of literary criticism. Back in the day, before there was a scholarly track of studying authors, what happened was that the critics, the beginning of literary criticism, was authors reading other authors and commenting on other authors. So it was equally important to be favored by the public and to be positively reviewed by your peers. This peer-to-peer commentary was the translation of what modern-day criticism is, where there's a a distinct segregation between the authors on one side and the critics on the other. Before, those roles were part of the same thing. Now, his fictions are never going to need closure. They're as far away from closure as you can get. They're open to interpretation. And that brings me to another key word, ambiguity. Because of this ambiguity, his work has been repeatedly interpreted, reinterpreted, definitely interpreted, redefinitely interpreted, time and time again by the post-structuralists, new literary historians, the reader response theorists, feminists, deconstructionists. Take into consideration that, for example, from the feminist point of view, feminist, why feminism? Scarlett Evans is the first female character that is a lead character of an American novel. Not only that, she's a heroine of the story. So she's put in the worst situation possible, humiliated by her community, and she emerges as a hero. So it's a very bold move, very much in the opposite direction of probably what the readership wanted to read, because it was putting Puritanism against itself, and it was applying a role to women that wasn't meant for women. And at the same time, it was sprinkled with all this romantic and gothic supernatural that Crawford, Melville, and Poe liked so much, with the tints of darkness and all. How does he create these complex, ambiguous works with the calculated use of irony, paradox, symbolism, complexity, what I said before, psychological depth, subtlety, density of composition, and deliberate ambiguities that go as far as the names of the character. Dr. McBrown, as a name of a story, is a typical everyman story. I don't know if you see it with Nick. I think Nick is the best teacher you could ever wish for in literature. When Nick introduced you to these everyman stories, one of the particularities is that they're set as examples. The names are purposefully selected. And we're going to see that in today's story, the main protagonist, young Goodman Brown, is married to his lovely wife, Faith. So he's married to Faith. And that's the initial paradox of the story. And his journey throughout the story is how he's going to lose Faith. Underscore and capital letters, both at the same time. So this playing with the game, with the words, at different levels, these different levels of reading is what makes his stories so interesting. His work is currently viewed as a revolt against the sentimentalized literature of the time. But this sentimentalized literature was done by women. So at the same time, feminists have all the reasons to love Hawthorne, they have all the reasons to hate Hawthorne. Because he was the biggest critic of women writing literature, and he was the biggest defender of women, putting a very strong woman at the forefront of his most important work of art. So this is what makes him a multi-layer and difficult to understand author, because he lives in this ambivalence. The purity of his literary style, the Poe called grammatically complex, yet rhetorically subtle, is one of the most appreciated factors in his writing. What we said before, that we're going to be able to reuse as a term, psychological depth. His prose is intentionally old-fashioned. He uses words that were already out of use at his time. Just imagine. He was hard to read for his contemporary work, readers. Imagine reading him nowadays. It adds a layer of complication. And there are archaisms, even for his own time. regarding the work of the founder of Hawthorne, it took him a very long time to get published, and at the beginning, after the initial failure of the fan shop, he had to recur, and we're going to see that again, for example, in Kitchen 10. Super failure, let's write short stories. And his short stories are easy to write, I get them published, I get paid, I eat that month. It's a commonsensical choice of life. I can understand it perfectly well. It took Hawthorne a long time to get published, and it came as at his own expense. After that failure, he was very, very affected by the humiliation of not being liked by the public. It's very hard to face failure, and we're going to see how failure and failing to be recognized as a relevant author is one of the biggest anxieties of writers. And we're going to see another good example at the end of the romanticism of Walt Whitman. His biggest dream was for people to like his poetry and for people to read him, and he was unsuccessful for the majority of his life achieving that. Even though nowadays he's considered the pinnacle of American poetry, one of the three or four most important poets, for many, the most important poets. But at the time of his publishing, he was tremendously unsuccessful. The founder often went through the same case. What was his solution to this? Well, get a job, first of all, that's what you do. And once you got a job, try to continue publishing, because he really wanted to publish anonymously in magazines and journals all around the United States. And at a certain point, he compiled all those stories, and he published them again. And that's why his book of tales are called Twice Told Tales. Because they had already been published, normally anonymously, and he decided to compile them and includes some of them, many of them, not young Luther Brown, for example, which he probably didn't consider good enough to be in this compilation, into the Twice Told Tales. these stories display the major themes that we see in Hawthorne. Puritan's past and the ambiguous heritage, human sin and guilt, the messages of nature, the Faustian pursuit of perfection, the birthmark, in the early 1930s, when he started to write these stories, no one influenced on him. Afterwards, he was convinced by Horatio Bridge to compile the stories in the Twice Told Tales. And this name stems from a Shakespearean quote, as it says there, or that's one of the theories for why he chose that name. His work of long fiction came late in his life, came in the last decades of his life, and it was not until 1850 when he published the Scarlet Letter. We're going to see how this year, 1850, and the surrounding years around it are going to be, bless you, going to be very important for American literature. There are many works of art that are very significant that are going to be published around that time, around the mid 19th century, and it's going to mark also the beginning of the end of American Romanticism. The House of Seven Gables in 1851 and the Blithedale Romance in 1852. His most appreciated novels and probably the work upon which his reputation lies upon nowadays, especially his Scarlet Letter in terms of reputation. I mean, the United States is one of the typical books that we read during elementary school or high school. He wrote a biography of Franklin Pierce, one year after the Scarlet Letter, there was a book of fiction called Moby Dick. Maybe you've heard about it. That was written by a novel that would deal with next week. And Herman Melville wrote in the dedication, in token of my admiration for his genius, this book is ascribed to Nathaniel Hawthorne. So, Moby Dick is like the Don Quixote of American literature. It's probably the most important, the single most important work of art in American literature, and it's inscribed to Nathaniel Hawthorne. Even though for us nowadays it's complicated to understand the dimension, the literary dimension of Nathaniel Hawthorne, all the doors that he opened for other writers to continue or for other authors to evolve. In his own time, he did receive the appreciation by his peers, especially by other generations of readers, not his contemporary readers, and I think that's what makes him so important. I have two more slides to go, I think. Yeah, three more slides to go. Three more slides to go. I'll try to go very fast so we can read the story. First of all, this idea, we've been using the word romance and novel and even novella back and forth without closing in on what that was. Sir Walter Scott, that we've already talked about here, defined the romance as a fictitious narrative in prose or verse, the interest of which turns upon the marvelous and uncommon incidents. So these are romances, and the four full-length novel would probably not be called novels nowadays. Just a footnote to you feel more comfortable with the term romance, the term novel, the term novella. It was actually the word that was used in the past, romance, the word that is currently used, novel, and in the middle, we have like semi-long stories that are longer than a short story. They're called novellas, and that's what makes it a bit more challenging to understand nowadays. Hawthorne, in the preface of The House of Seven Gables, regarded the novel as the presumed aim at a very renewed fidelity, not merely to the possible, but to the probable and ordinary course of man's experience. Similar to the current realistic novel. So, at the time, novel was used for realism and for paying attention to the real the happenings of the world, and romance, where you could let go of your imagination and explore the possible, the mysterious, the supernatural. Romance gives Hawthorne the platform that he needs to explore these irrational forces and to go beyond what the reader is expecting and to take his expectations to unexplored territory. Especially to explore how the human mind is altered by the course of events and going beyond what empiricism gave us. So if we had to contrast him with someone, we could probably contrast him with both Benjamin Franklin and Jonathan Edwards, which were, especially Edwards, a huge fan of empiricism. The author always insisted on judging his works as romances, and if you use indistinctly the words when you take your examination, you have to be careful to make it very clear that you understand the difference. You're just using it for current purposes and in one sense or another. I promise to go fast, so I'll do so. Young Goodman Brown and some notes on the Scarlet Letter. Regarding Young Goodman Brown, it's an example of an allegory that is very close to the literary forms of a fable or a parable. It is probably Hawthorne's best example of how he had a likening for allegorizing evil. I want to turn on the light, maybe two bar videos to take notes. At least one. Can you still see? Yeah. Okay.
The literature on light,
to light.
Yeah.
I can't get black on the black.
Let me say, is there any way of extending this?
Is there a way of zooming this? I don't know. I have no idea. They changed the platform this year. Everything's easier.
Keeping just getting easier. Okay, I don't know. I don't know how to zoom that. I'll have a look and see if I can do that. Maybe there's too much work, and like I can probably work on that. And yeah, but I don't know how to zoom. I don't know how to zoom in the previous platform. I knew how to zoom, and all my know-how is gone for this new platform.
I have to ask if that's possible. What we're going to see is a lot of double meaning.
Exploration of evil. And from the literary point of view, he probably considered it to have less literary quality than others and excluded it intentionally from the twice-fulfilled tome. Apart from the allegorical interpretations, there are other elements that we can bring to the front, such as morals, philosophy, history, and psychology. The morals of guilt, arrogance, and how the Puritans basically had a way of saying we're the saints, we're the others, we're the good, you're the evil, we're going towards salvation, you're going towards damnation. That binary opposition, that polarization of reality that Puritanism has is what Hawthorne plays with and puts in the focus this arrogance that Puritans have of being the chosen people, of thinking that they were much more special than all the rest of the souls on the planet. And ideas that Puritans, because they were very convenient, brought to the table and decided to think that it was really reasonable to think about witchcraft, come to interpretations of the devil, good and bad faith, or what innocence signified among others. All of these motifs are part of the story that we're going to read. Puritan sins in the silent witch hunts are present as what we said at the beginning, this sense of guilt that does not wash away, does not wash off Hawthorne in any moment. Finally, the Scarlet Letter. It was written right at the in the middle of the 19th century, and it was his return to a full-length novel after a period of writing short stories and literary obscurity. It became his most successful book, although he never became rich from the sales of this book, and it has always been considered America's first great novel. It is a historical romance, and it focuses on the adulterous love between a Puritan minister, that's a bit of a spoiler there, and Hester Prynne, a married member of his congregation in the Boston of two centuries before. So there is a sense of guilt, not only in his salad, but also in all of New England. And the more Puritan area that surrounded where Massachusetts and the places that he was familiar with. There is a very calculated distance between the historical, religious, literary, and emotional New England of the past and the transcendentalist New England that was contemporary to him. So he set his book in a previous period to what he was living on purpose because it served his narrative much better than writing it at the same placing it at the same time. He placed it in a previous time and that allowed him a big amount of criticism without directly offending people, even though it was not very successful at that. The story starts with a love affair. It doesn't start with the love affair itself, but from the consequences of the love affair. And how this lady has survived after being forced to wear a red leather and climb onto a scaffold. A scaffold is like a platform or a stage or something like that. To be publicly humiliated by the entire community, which is a very cruel way of coming to a punishment. She was forced to wear the word as a sign of shame for the rest of her life. And that leads us to asking, what happened to whoever she was unfaithful with? Nothing, of course, because it was a guy. But she does not only own her situation, she exploits it, and she creates, because she is a seamstress, a beautiful, marvelously embroidered letter A that she wears on her bosom. And A stands for adulteress. Okay? So I really recommend you, this is a fantastic read. Summer's coming sooner or later. Write it down on your... I don't know. I try not to watch those. I tend to get disappointed when I watch the movies that are based on books. The dialect that comes out of the adultery, Pearl, has a name of purity, represents the opposite of what the Puritans consider purity. And you see how he uses all these ideas of natural innocence and release from Eden as subversive motives in his book very early on. You're going to see how they become tainted with guilt and fear. The Scarlet Letter, as well as the Moon Brown, is a tremendous work of allegory and symbolism. I have 25 minutes to read through. I'm going to leave what I wanted to read today as an introduction for next week. I'm going to read from Young Goodman Brown. Let me find it. Professor Gibbet says on page 224 of the textbook, when reading the tale, it should be borne in mind that its protagonist does not represent Orthodox Calvinism as exemplified by first generation Puritans, but a declining form of religion held by a troubled and confused third generation of Puritans who were historical victims of an altered relationship with God. We've already seen this time and time again, how the first generation of Puritans become so disappointed with the following generations that are not able to sustain that covenant, and therefore comes the awakening. It's a failed attempt to go back to the Puritan standards. Calvinist preachers continually warn their congregations against presumption, that is, the act of declaring one's salvation already certain. Just because you're a Puritan doesn't mean you're saved. You have to work towards that salvation every step of your life, every day of your life. That's what Young Goodman Brown is about. It's like, I'm going to live this last night of temptation. I'm curious, and I'm going to have a look at what temptation and sin look like, and then I'm going to go back, and I'm going to be happy and Puritan and pure again, and I'm going to be really, really worthy of entering heaven. Young Goodman Brown. That's the basis of the story. Young Goodman Brown came forth at sunset into the streets of Salem Village, but put his head back after crossing the threshold to exchange a parting kiss with his young wife. And Faith, as the wife was aptly named, thrust her own pretty head into the street, letting the wind play with the pink ribbons of her cap, while she called to Goodman Brown. "Dearest heart," whispered she softly and rather sadly, when her lips were close to his ear. "Pry thee, put off your journey until sunrise and sleep in your own bed tonight. A lone woman is troubled with such dreams and such sharp thoughts that she's afeard of herself sometimes. Pray tarry with me this night, dear husband, of all nights in the year." Because of all the nights in the year, he decides to set forth on the nights of all the weeks, of all the witches, of Halloween. Okay? As that day has come to be known nowadays. Oops. My loving faith, replied Edmund Brown, of all the nights in the year, this one night must I tarry away from thee. My journey, as thou callest it, and forth and back again, must need to be done. Twixt now and sunrise, what my sweet pretty wife does build out, me already, and we but 3 months married. So he's recently been married. Then God bless you, said Faith, with the pink ribbons, and may you find all well when you come back. Amen, cried Goodman Brown. Say thy prayers, dear Faith, and go to bed at dusk, and no harm will come to thee. So they parted, and the young man pursued his way until being about to turn the corner by the meeting house, he looked back and saw the head of Faith still peeping after him with a melancholy air in spite of her pink ribbons. Poor little Faith. And every time you read one of these exclamations, you could change Faith for just a normal word, not the name, and you'll come to another conclusion. Poor little Faith, thought he, for his heart smote him. What a wretch am I to leave her on such an errand. She talks of dreams, too, methought. As she spoke, there was trouble in her face, as if a dream had warned her what work is to be done tonight. But no, 'twould kill her to think it. Well, she's a blessed angel on earth, and after this one night, I'll cling to her skirts and follow her to heaven. With this excellent resolve for the future, Goodman Brown felt himself justified in making more haste on the present evil purpose. He had taken a dreary road darkened by the gloomiest trees of the forest, which barely stood aside, to let the narrow path creep through and close immediately behind. It was all as lonely as could be, and there is this peculiarity in such a solitude, that the traveler knows not who may be concealed by the innumerable trunks and the thick boughs overhead, so that with lonely footsteps he may yet be passing through an unseen multitude. There may be a devilish Indian behind every tree, said Goodman Brown to himself, and he glanced fearfully behind him as he added, what if the devil himself should be at my very elbow? His head being turned back, he passed the crook of the road, and looking forward again, beheld the figure of a man in grave and decent attire, seated at the foot of an old tree. He arose at Goodman Brown's approach and walked onward side by side with him. You are late, Goodman Brown, said he. The clock of the old south was striking as I came through Boston, and this is full 15 minutes agone. And now, double meaning again. Faith kept me back a while, replied the young man, with a tremor in his voice, caused by the sudden appearance of his companion, though not wholly unexpected. It was now deep dusk in the forest, and deepness in that part of it where these two were journeying, as nearly as could be discerned. The second traveler was about 50 years old, apparently in the same rank of life as Goodman Brown, and bearing a considerable resemblance to him, though perhaps more in expressions and features. Still, they might have been taken for father and son. And yet, though the elder person was as simply clad as the younger and as simple in manner too, he had an indescribable air of one who knew the world and would not have felt abashed at the governor's dinner table or in King William's court, were it possible that his affairs should call him thither. But the only thing about him that could be fixed upon as remarkable was his staff, which bore the likeness of a great black snake, so curiously wrought that it might also almost be seen to twist and wriggle itself like a living serpent. This, of course, must have been an ocular deception, assisted by the uncertain light. So he's a man in his 50s carrying a staff that resembles a snake. I don't know. You don't have to have a lot of imagination to work. Come, Goodman Brown, cried his fellow traveler. This is a dull pace for the beginning of a journey. Take my staff if you are so soon weary. friend, said the other, exchanging his slow pace for a full stop. Having kept covenant by meeting thee, it is my purpose now to return whence I came. I have scruples touching the matter that thou wast of. Sayest thou so, replied he of the serpent, smiling apart. Let us walk on, nevertheless, reasoning as we go, and if I convince thee not, thou shalt turn back. We are but a little way in the forest yet. Too far, exclaimed the good man. And it's not in capital letters, on purpose. Unconsciously resuming his walk. My father never went into the woods on such an errand, nor his father before him. We have been a race of honest men and good Christians since the days of the martyrs, and shall I be the first of the name of Brown that ever took this path and kept such company, one would say, observed the elder person, interpreting his pause. Well said, Goodman Brown. I have been as well acquainted with your family as with ever of one among the Puritans. And that's no trifle to say. I helped your grandfather, the constable, when he lashed the Quaker woman so smartly through the streets of Salem. This is a direct reference to the witches of Salem, the trials of Salem. And it was I that brought your father a pitch pine knot kindled at my own hearth to set fire to an Indian village in King Philip's War. We were already talking about King Philip's War. They were my good friends, both, and many a pleasant walk have we had along this path and returned merrily after midnight. I would fain be friends with you for their sake. So he's already been friends to his grandfather and to his father. If it be as thou sayest, replied Goodman Brown, I marvel they never spoke of these matters, for verily, I marvel not seeing that the least rumor of the sort would have driven them from New England. We are a people of prayer and good works to boot, and abide no such wickedness. Wickedness or not, said the traveler with a twisted staff, I have a very general acquaintance here in New England. The deacons of many a church have drunk the communion wine with me. The selectmen of divers towns make me their chairman, and a majority of the great and general court are firm supporters of my interest. The governor and I, too, but these are state secrets. Can this be so? Cried Goodman Brown, with a stare of amazement at his undisturbed companion. How be it? I have nothing to do with the governor and the council. They have their own ways and are no rule for a simple husbandman like me. But were I to go on with thee, how should I meet the eye of that good old man, our minister at Salem Village? Oh, his voice would make me tremble, both Sabbath day and lecture day. Thus far, the elder traveler had listened with due gravity, but now burst into a fit of irrepressible mirth, shaking himself so violently that his snake-like staff actually seemed to wriggle in sympathy. Ha ha ha, shouted he again and again, then composing himself. Well, go on, Goodman Brown, go on, but pray thee, don't kill me with laughing. Well then, to end the matter at once, said Goodman Brown, considerably nettled, there is my wife. Faith, I would break her dear little heart, and I'd rather break my own. Nay, if that be the case, answered the other, even go thy ways, Goodman Brown. I would not for 20 old women, like the one hobbling before us, that Faith should come to any harm. As he spoke, he pointed his staff at the female figure on the path, in whom Goodman Brown recognized a very pious and exemplary dame who had taught him his catechism in youth and was still his moral and spiritual advisor, jointly with the minister and Deacon Goodkin. A marvel truly that Goody Cloyes should be so far in the wilderness at nightfall, said he. But with your leave, friend, I shall take a cut through the woods until we have left this Christian woman behind. Being a stranger to you, she might ask whom I was consorting with and whither I was going. Be it so, said the fellow traveler. Betake you to the woods and let me keep the path. Accordingly, the young man turned aside, but took care to watch his companion, who advanced softly along the road until he had come within a staff length of the old dame. She, meanwhile, was making the best of her way with singular speed for so aged a woman. and mumbling some indistinct words of prayer, doubtless, as she went. The traveler put forth his staff and touched her withered neck with what seemed the serpent's tail. "The devil!" screamed the pious old lady. "Then Goody Cloyse knows her old friend," observed the traveler, confronting her and leaning on his writhing stick. "Ah, forsooth, and is it your worship indeed?" cried the good dame. "Yeah, truly is it, and in the very image of my old gossip, Goodman Brown, the grandfather of the silly fellow that now is. But would your worship believe it? My broomstick has threateningly disappeared, stolen, as I suspect, by the unhanged witch, Goody Corby. And that, too, when I was all anointed with a juice of smallage and cinquefoil and wolf's bane, mingled with fine wheat and the fat of a newborn babe," said the shape of old Goodman Brown. "Then, ah, your worship, it knows a recipe," cried the old lady, cackling aloud. Cackle is the type of laugh that only witches do. So, as I was saying, being all ready for the meeting and no horse to ride on, I made up my mind to foot it. For they tell me there is a nice young man to be taken into communion tonight. But now your good worship will bend to your arm, and we shall be there in a twinkling. "That can hardly be," answered her friend. "I may not spare you my arm, Goody Cloyse, but here is my staff, if you will." So saying, she threw it down at her feet, where perhaps it assumed life, being one of the rods which its owner had formerly lent to the Egyptian magi. Of this fact, however, Goodman Brown could not take any cognizance. He had cast up his eyes in astonishment, and looking down below, looking down again, beheld neither Goody Cloyse nor the serpentine staff, but his fellow traveler alone, who waited for him as calmly as if nothing had happened. "That old lady taught me my catechism," said the young man, and there was a world of meaning in this simple comment. They continued to walk onward, while the elder traveler exhorted his companion to make good speed and persevere in the path, discoursing so aptly that his arguments seemed rather to spring up in the bosom of the auditor than to be suggested by himself. As they went, he plucked a branch of maple to serve for a walking stick, and began to strip it of the twigs and little boughs which were wet with evening dew. The moment his fingers touched them, they became strangely withered and dried up, as with a week's sunshine. This idea of a weak sunshine, it follows the idea that 2 months of a good thing is bad. Okay? Thus, the pair proceeded at a good free pace, until suddenly, in gloomy hollow of the road, Goodman Brown sat himself down on the stump of a tree and refused to go any farther. "Friend," said he stubbornly, "my mind is made up. Not another step will I budge on this errand. What if a wretched old woman could choose to go to the devil, when I thought she was going to heaven? Is that any reason why I should quit my dear faith and go after her? You will think better of this by and by," said his acquaintance composedly. "Sit here and rest yourself a while, and when you feel like moving again, there is my staff to help you along." Without more words, he threw his companion the maple stick and was speedily out of sight, as if he had vanished into the deepening gloom. The young man sat a few moments by the roadside, applauding himself greatly and thinking with how clear a conscience he should meet the minister in the morning walk, nor shrink from the eyes of the good old Deacon Buchan, and what calm sleep would be his that very night, which was to have been spent so wickedly, but purely and sweetly now in the arms of faith. Amidst these pleasant and praiseworthy meditations, Goodman Brown heard the tramp of the horses along the road, and deemed it advisable to conceal himself within the verge of the forest. Conscious of the guilty purpose that had brought him thither, and though now so happily turned from it, on came the hoof tramps and the voices of the riders, two grave old voices conversing soberly as they drew near. These mingled sounds appeared to pass along the road within a few yards of the young man's hiding place. But owing doubtless to the depth of the gloom at that particular spot, neither the travelers nor the steeds were visible. Though their figures brushed the small boughs by the wayside, it could not be seen that they intercepted even for a moment the faint beam from the strip of bright light athwart which they must have passed. Goodman Brown alternately crouched and stood on tiptoe, pulling aside the branches and thrusting forth his head as far as he durst, without discerning so much as a shadow. It vexed him the more because he could have sworn it were such a thing possible that he recognized the voices of the minister and Deacon Gookin, jogging along quietly as they were about to do, went down to some ordination or ecclesiastical council. While yet within hearing, one of the riders stopped to cut the switch. One of the two, Reverend Sir, said the voice like the deacon's, I had rather miss an ordination dinner than tonight's meeting. They tell me that some of our community are to be here from Falmouth and beyond, and others from Connecticut and Rhode Island, besides several of the Indian powwows, who, after their fashion, know almost as much deviltry as the best of us. Moreover, there is a goodly young woman to be taken into communion. Mighty well, we can look in, replied the solemn old tones of the minister. Spur up or we shall be late. Nothing can be done, you know, until I get on the ground. The hoofs clattered again, and the voices, talking so strangely in the empty air, passed on through the forest, where no church had ever been gathered nor solitary Christian played. Whither then could these holy men be journeying so deep into the heath and wilderness? Young Goodman Brown caught hold of a tree for support, being ready to sink down on the ground, faint and overburdened with the heavy sickness of his heart. He looked up to the sky, doubting whether there really was a heaven above him. Yet there was a blue arc and the stars brightening in it. With heaven above and faith below, I will yet stand firm against the devil, cried Goodman Brown. We're going to run out of time, which is something that always happens to me with this narrative because it's really, really long. And after the experience that a young Goodman Brown lives in the forest, I would like to ask you to move to the final pages where he comes back from this outlandish experience and feels that he's been betrayed by his entire community and everyone is possessed by the devil. And he changes his view of everything, including faith. And he says, the next morning, young Goodman Brown came slowly into the streets of Salem Village, staring around him like a bewildered man. The good old minister was taking a walk along the graveyard to get an appetite for breakfast and meditate his sermon and bestowed a blessing as he passed on Goodman Brown. He shrank from the venerable saint as if to avoid an anathema. Old Deacon Gookin was at domestic worship, and the holy words of his prayer were heard through the open window. What God does the withered pray to, quoth Goodman Brown. Willie Cloyce, that excellent old Christian, stood in the early sunshine at her own lattice, catechizing a little girl who had brought her a pint of morning's milk. Goodman Brown snatched away the child as from the grasp of the fiend himself. Turning the old corner by the meeting house, he spied the head of faith with the pink ribbons gazing anxiously forth, and bursting into such joy at sight of him that she skipped along the street and almost kissed her husband before the whole village. But Goodman Brown looked sternly and sadly into her face and passed on without a greeting. Had Goodman Brown fallen asleep in the forest and only dreamed the wild dream of a witch meeting? Be it so, if you will, but alas, it was a dream of evil omen for young Goodman Brown. A stern, a sad, a darkly meditative, a distrustful, if not desperate man that he became. From the night of that fearful dream, on the Sabbath day when the congregation were singing a holy song, he could not listen because an anthem of sin rushed loudly upon his ear and drowned all the blessed strain. When the minister spoke from the pulpit with power and fervent eloquence, and with his hands on the open Bible of the sacred truth of our religion and of the saints' like lives of that triumphant death and of future bliss or misery unutterable, then the Goodman Brown turned pale, dreading lest the roof should thunder down upon the great blasphemy and his hearers. Often awaking suddenly at midnight, he shrank from the bosom of faith, and at morning or eventide, when the family
knelt down at prayer, he scowled and muttered to himself and gazed sternly at his wife and turned away. And when he had lived long and was borne to his grave, a hoary corpse, followed by Faith, an aged woman, and children and grandchildren, a goodly procession besides neighbors, not a few, they carved no hopeful verse upon his tombstone, for his dying hour was gloomy. Okay, so it's a very positive and optimistic ending to the story. Okay, so the next week we're going to continue with Herman Melville. Thank you very much. Great to have new faces. Please keep coming. Don't connect from home. Experience is much worse. The audio sound is terrible. Come here. Have a great week. Okay? Bye. Oh, thanks a lot. Thank you.